So I have an article in front of me. It's from The Citizen. It actually quotes my next guest. But before we get into it, I just want to give you a bit of background. So there has been a report by Stats South Africa and the Department of Basic Education. They assert that hundreds of girls, and I'm going to repeat that word, hundreds of girls, not tens, hundreds of girls between the ages of 10 and 14 have fallen pregnant in this country, with many undergoing terminations. Apparently this has sparked debate. It has sparked outrage, deep concern, you name it, there have been the reactions. And my guest is perfectly placed to talk to this issue and what can be done about it, if in fact anything can be done about it. She is Dr. Shahida Omar. She is the clinical director at the Teddy Bear Foundation, a foundation that aims to prevent and minimize child abuse in South Africa. Dr. Omar, thank you for chatting to me on Chai FM.
Thank you and good afternoon to all the listeners.
So I'm truly shocked by the figures contained in this particular newspaper article. Hundreds of girls between 10 and 14, with many undergoing terminations. How did we arrive at this point?
Well, I think we need to understand and appreciate that pregnancy amongst girls aged between 10 and 14 almost always suggests that there's sexual abuse or exploitation, because we know that children in this age cohort are not developmentally or even legally in a position to give informed consent. I think that so the issue of consent here, and we mustn't dismiss the fact that, of course, the sexual debuts are emerging earlier. And there are numerous risk factors that contribute to this as well. But let us just unpack this a little bit, Simon. I think if we look at the interrelated factors, I mentioned sexual abuse and exploitation. Mm-hmm. Now, often we are fully aware of the fact that these are not your typical stranger danger perpetrators that are coming and impregnating these learners. It's usually your relatives, your stepfathers, family friends, neighbors, educators who exploit children's dependence and lack of power. And then, of course, the issue of the landscape of poverty and unemployment. Here we see a lot of transactional sex and exploitation and parents are actually being complicit in the sense that they are amazed. They may have suspicions that something is going on, but because of the benefits, the money, the exchange of money, gifts, food being provided, and even school fees sometimes being provided as a result of that. So transactional sex has a huge role to play. Then we are, as I mentioned earlier, about the access to the internet, social media increasing without the digital safety awareness leads to grooming. We're finding a lot of children are exposed to online exploitation. Actually, the online exploitation is even more dangerous than the offline, because they are engaging with predators, with pedophiles, with traffickers that they're not actually aware of whom they're engaging with, because people are using avatars and hiding their identities, impersonating themselves. And of course, this is how the grooming begins and how they prey on these victims, and it becomes very difficult for the victims to then escape this. Another thing that we need to look at is, of course, I'm not going to go back there, poverty and the economic vulnerability, where families actually overlook that. But so these are structural and environmental factors, but also something that we find that the lack of education, where there's or lack of poor access to sexual reproductive health education. This often makes children more vulnerable, both your girls and boys, where they're engaging in sexual behavior without actually being informed about the long-term implications or the unintended consequences of that. And we've seen that a lot with the young girls that we are currently working with. We've been working with child pregnant learners since COVID, and we're running groups across Gauteng in the different regions. And we get referrals at one time, 20 young girls from a school in grade 10, So you're looking at your 15, 16-year-olds, and even sometimes younger, where these girls are already pregnant and unfortunately are not coping. Well, can a young child cope? Because we know a child birthing a child or a child carrying a child is not developmentally, emotionally, psychologically appropriate for a child to bear that kind of responsibility, I would say burden. So that is something, you know, we have to focus on the sexual reproductive health and rights education. But also looking at gender-based violence, where there's gender inequality and harmful social norms. Now, we know that in some contexts, in some cultures, early child marriage is accepted. The ukutwala that we see in KZ in some communities that still prevails, and even across the continent of Africa, we see this. But I think, and
ukutwala, if I remember, that's when you take the woman, you're pretty much kidnapping the kid, the woman.
Kidnapping the young child, indeed. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for clarifying that. And then, of course, we talk about gender-based violence, where we're looking at gender inequality and submissiveness to men are normalized. And with our SRHR programs, that's what we're seeing with the debates and discussions that when we engage both girls and boys, where boys actually say, no, the girl, when she says no, it's not no, she wants to be pursued, and that's just a tease, and we have to pursue her.
What is SRHR?
Sexual reproductive health and rights education at schools. We engage in leadership clubs for both girls and boys, and I think this is what is emerging if we look at the dynamics and the perceptions and perspectives that unpack as we deal with that. But I think we are also have to look at the other challenge that we are faced with is the inadequate child protection systems here, because we have the best pieces of policy and legislation. Unfortunately, it's the implementation on the ground. If we look just at the Department of SAPS, South African Police Services, their limited resources, they're overloaded with cases, the volumes that they have to deal with, and what we actually are faced with is inappropriate, inadequate, and not timeous responses. Because when a case is reported, because of the lack of training, sensitivity, often the responses are inappropriate and refrains victims and their families from coming to report, because the way it is managed, unfortunately. Then we look at limited social services. The case volumes for statutory social workers going out to make visits, engaging in the communities. Again, it's just there's a skewed or it's disproportionate. The demands outweigh what we have available. And again, the other issue around stigma, the issue of not reporting because of the social isolation, the judgmental responses and rejection. It's not only rejection by community, but immediate family members. We've done a lot of family therapy, family counseling, where we've had to bring in the primary caregivers or significant others engaging, verbalizing, ventilating their anger and disappointment, but at the same time ensuring that they hold this child, contain this child, and provide support. So that's a huge challenge that we have to understand. But I think, just in response to that, if we look at these cases, all the young girls that are faced with this and having to go for a termination of pregnancy is also something that they're not prepared for. Unfortunately, they go in for the TOP, termination of pregnancy, and return from that with no follow-up, no support, no containment, even healthcare. I think we understand healthcare has its limitations, social development limitations, and it's people like CSO, civil society organizations like Teddy Beck Foundation, and even the Jewish organizations, all sorts of other civil society organizations that come to the rescue. But, you cannot be all things to all people. The resources are limited. So there are psychological effects, the long-term implications, where we find that these girls in this age cohort and even older, where they faced with trauma and post-traumatic stress disorder because, there's no kind of ongoing support. They sit alone. They try to figure out, to process, to make sense. What are they going to do moving forward? They can't take care of themselves. It's a child that's now having another child. So the anxiety, the fear, the, you know, nightmares, and you find that we've seen a lot of depression. So the mental health is compromised. We've even seen cases of suicide that were in one school last, the latter part of last year. We saw 5 children in this age cohort who had completed suicides. So, you know, this is a harsh reality, unfortunately, if we look at how children are impacted even after the pregnancy, the guilt and shame, low self-esteem. Unfortunately, even the dropout, the attrition rate, and that's something that we work very hard on to try and ensure that the young girls do not leave school. And even where we've had young boys that have impregnated the learners who are actually leaving school to go and seek employment and provide some kind of financial support. So it is a huge, huge problem if we look at how it would perpetuate the cycle of poverty and dependence. But I think we also have to understand the health complications. These are children. So what happens to these children? They face high risks of infant mortality, maternal mortality, and then after childbirth, it's usually the obstetric fistula, you know, where they cannot even, they lose bladder control. Sometimes they hemorrhage, and I already mentioned the maternal mortality. So there are so many complications and so many challenges that we have to realize that this is a systemic issue. You know, it's not A results in B. Unfortunately, it's not just a lineal thing. There are systemic challenges that we have to look at. And of course, if we look at how can we work towards protecting
that was the next children. Question. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, again, it's looking at strengthening our legal policy frameworks here. You know, again, ensuring that.
You've just told me, though, that we've got great legal frameworks, that it's enforcement is where we fall down. You know, you spoke about SAPs not. Well, that's all very well. So then you get SAPs to leather, and then you've got to go through a justice system that actually has to press a charge. It just seems there are so many points of failure in this whole process, and the kids are being victimized all the way through to the end, and then they become broken adults. So we're in a bad place here. Wow. What do you do? What does your foundation do to try and assist ameliorate the issue?
What we do, thank you for asking that, Simon. Before I go to that question, answer the question, I just want to bring it to the attention of the listeners, is that we have found that so many learners are impregnated at school by supporting staff, by educators, and those perpetrators are let off the hook. Mm-hmm. Sometimes there isn't proper vetting or screening against the different registers. Furthermore, the moment they get wind of the fact that they are going to be there's going to be an inquiry, there'll be disciplinaries, they disappear. They disappear into the sunset and work at another school, perpetuating the cycle of abuse. Or sometimes compensation is provided to the family, and the family, out of desperation and need, do nothing about it. So if we look at the National Child Care Protection Register, that's also where the systems are failing us. Education, DSD, justice. But coming back to your question about what are we doing as an organization? Conduct community sensitization campaigns. We work with children, but we also work with parents, going out into the communities, going out into the hotspot areas, the disadvantaged communities where resources are few and far between, and of course, lack of awareness, lack of support, and you know, for them to understand the referral pathways, their rights, responsibilities. And also, what we do is provide training to parents and caregivers. I think the buzz word now is on positive parenting, and if we look at the INSPIRE strategy, the acronym INSPIRE, P speaks specifically to parental support and positive parenting, where it was developed by the World Health Organization, and that is something that has been adopted in South Africa as well, if we're looking at ending violence against children. But we also work closely with schools, going out to the schools, of course, continuing what Department of Basic Education has developed on the comprehensive sexuality education. So it's age-appropriate, rights-based information that is provided to children to heighten their awareness and to ensure that they are more informed in making choices. But I also mentioned, you know, the girls and boys leadership clubs. So we engage a lot with more with the senior primary and high school learners around sexual rights, you know, around SRHR, and also making them aware of the referral pathways, where they can report, making them aware of the toll-free hotlines, I think not only to the children, but out in the communities and even in workplaces. So in the corporate sectors, we actually go out and empower employees on what to look out for, signs and symptoms if their child has been a victim of abuse, where do they report it, and how do they get support. So it's more of a holistic approach. I think that is important to understand, that we cannot just work with children, we work with educators, because many times there are many educators that would label a child as being oppositionally defiant, a child that, you know, they're not sure. So, oh, that child is rebellious, that child is stupid, that child is a troublemaker. Meanwhile, that child is facing so much trauma, has been a victim of abuse, has a history of victimization, and unfortunately, the educator is not equipped or empowered to identify that this child is in need and needs help. So that's where we strengthen coordination. So it's collaboration with schools, health services, law enforcement, child protection agencies. And of course, we have a strong data capturing system where we track these cases. So we do follow-ups to see where they're in the system, what has happened, have they received support, and follow up on that. So I think that's just basically what I wanted to say. And I think we need to appreciate and understand that these young girls, we cannot label them as bad, as dirty, or as ugly. They are a symptom of deep systemic failure. And we have a huge responsibility to protect these children, all children, actually.
Dr. Omar, what incredibly important work you are doing. Thank you so much. And thank you for chatting to me today on Chai FM.